This is an RNZ podcast.
Kia ora, ko William Rea Ho. Sorry, this is not a new season of Black Sheep. There's probably a few more months' work to go on that, but I promise I will have it to you before the end of the year. In the meantime, I have something excellent to tide you over. One of my workmates at RNZ, Jamie Tahana, recently produced an episode of The House, which is a podcast on all the weird and wonderful things which happen in Parliament. I thought Black Sheep listeners might like this particular episode because Jamie takes a look at the history of Parliament through a slightly unusual lens, and we're all about weird lenses at Black Sheep. But in Jamie's case, this lens is the bottom of a whiskey glass. His show is called Gin and Beer It, Parliament's Boozy Past.
Today, Parliament likes to talk of itself as being as family-friendly as possible. There's 46 women MPs, infants are allowed in the House, and there are even plans to build a playground out front. But it hasn't always been that way. For much of the past couple of hundred years, New Zealand and alcohol have gone hand in hand, or bottle in hand. Alcohol arrived with the early settlers. Captain James Cook tried to brew his own with young remu branches. Māori called it waipiro, or rotten water. Much of New Zealand's history can be traced to the banks of a raging river of alcohol, or the shores of a deep lake of whiskey, where the publican was as important as the chaplain. If the colour of New Zealand history has been stained burgundy, then nowhere is that more vivid than in the history of Parliament.
It doesn't give you much time to run up to an election, Prime Minister.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
While most people know of Sir Robert Muldoon's infamous 1984 Schnapps election, where the Prime Minister stumbled down to call an election late one night, it's by no means the only, or even the worst, example of liquor-infused politics. John Martin is an historian who's written extensively on the history of Parliament. He says much in the way that Parliament is supposed to reflect society, New Zealand's very first Parliament was a reflection of its vices. Exhibit A. When Britain gave New Zealand the power to pass its own laws, the first thing we did was open a bar.
Believe it or not, the very first legislation which they passed was legislation enabling the consumption of liquor in Auckland's Parliament.
New Zealand's first law was to open a bar for themselves.
Sadly, yes, the first law under representative government in 1854, once Parliament had assembled. There were previous forms of law that had been passed in the former Crown Colony period. But they wanted to make sure straight away that they had facilities to sort of sustain themselves, I suppose one could say. And so that was part of it. So when they all arrived in Auckland after rather arduous trips in ships and found that they were going to inhabit what was really not much more than a rudimentary barn with a little annex out the back, which was where Bellamy's was, Bellamy's being the restaurant and bar for the MPs. And so they, as soon as they got down to work, they passed this little piece of legislation which meant that they could enjoy themselves there.
And they sure did enjoy themselves. Before long, Bellamy's earned itself a debaucherous reputation as some kind of superior gentleman's club.
I think in those days, in the sort of colonial settler New Zealand, liquor was an important part of enjoying life. And the MPs, I guess, thought they'd attained a relatively privileged position, and so they should have this additional privilege of easy access to liquor at good prices. And as Jock Phillips' book, A Man's Country, quite a while ago now, but as he sort of demonstrated, it was a very integral part of the culture of the New Zealand male, and of course all the MPs in those days were male. And before long, they'd started organising themselves. They had what was called the House Committee, which was a way of describing how they could make themselves comfortable, if you like, by improving the buildings they worked in, but also keeping a good eye on Bellamy's and the kind of liquor that they could consume there. So the House Committee...
Because they brought themselves in some quite fine stuff, didn't they?
Well, that was what I was about to say, actually. The House Committee, before too long, used to have a regular routine of drawing up lists of the kind of liquor that they wanted and then sending across to Britain in the form of orders, and it would be shipped here in bulk. And brought in to Parliament and served up at the bar.
And the MPs necked it like nectar. How about this? In 1871, a single 60-day session got through 50 dozen bottles of champagne, a hogshead and 72 bottles of claret, 4 casks of sherry, a cask of port, and 4 cases of wine, as well as numerous other ales, wines and liqueurs. Bellamy's even stocked its own brand of liquor, exclusively for MPs. In his 1957 book, Grog's Own Country, Conrad Bollinger writes that by the end of the 19th century, to be a parliamentarian, one necessarily had to be a toper.
The widespread suspicion that much of the legislation of this period was being considered in a miasma of whisky fumes probably served as a stimulus to the temperance movement. There would be something very annoying about the thought that decisions affecting the whole national life were, in effect, being made at a drunken party.
I spoke with John Martin in Parliament's library, which once had 2 chambers, a reading room in the middle, and Bellamy's out behind, only a few steps away from each other. In its small, ornate interior, with bourbon brown wood panelling, sherry red walls, and frosted gin-like glass, parliamentarians would linger through the dead of the night. But working hard and drinking hard often led to some, well, unstatesmanlike escapades.
Occasions where one party jostling for power with the government would lay down a strategy of getting certain key MPs who might swing the vote one way or the other drunk, and then while they were sort of semi-comatose, locking them in a room so they weren't able to get to the chamber to vote. And in the early 1870s, there was one classic episode where both parties were actually vying for the support of this particular poor unfortunate, Edward Jerningham Wakefield, who did become an alcoholic. And he was locked in such a room, and then the opposition got wind of that, tried to keep him further supplied with liquor by lowering a bottle of liquor down the chimney on a piece of string. It was all up in the air as to who he's going to vote for, but when they finally unlocked the door, he did make it to the division, and he voted against the people who put him in the room, and I don't know whether that was intentional or not, but another one that comes to mind is what was recorded as the longest ever speech made in the House of more than 24 hours, would you believe?
Straight.
Well, more or less straight. It was actually helped along by the liquor, that's what I was about to say. There would have been one or two meal breaks that punctuated, but he kept on his feet for just over 24 hours. But the story does go that he wouldn't allowed to have liquor in the chamber, obviously, anyway. And so there were these carafes of water, but someone in changing over one of these carafes had clearly brought in some kind of gin or something, because everyone noticed that this water was looking suspiciously cloudy. Anyway, the MP managed to keep on his hind legs for the full 24 hours plus. You've got stories of people sort of misbehaving themselves as a result of liquor, fights in the lobbies, all sorts of things which seem to be part of the culture.
What led to that culture of the time?
Well, I think you've got to remember it's nothing like today's Parliament in terms of the annual pattern. It was compressed into a very short part of the year during the winter, and they'd be rushing through an enormous mass of legislation. They'd be working extraordinarily long hours into the early hours of the morning. Sometimes the sittings would go on for several days or weeks without much of a break at all. And as a sort of, if you like, as an antidote to that incredibly intense life, they wanted to relax in all sorts of ways. They were living in often cheap boarding houses or cheap hotels in the vicinity of the Parliament buildings, which didn't really have a lot of entertainment available. And so they would use Parliament's facilities, like their own living room or whatever, in all sorts of ways.
Still, there was a lot of alcoholism at that time, wasn't there? I mean, Jerningham Wakefield's the prominent
example. The one which I had in mind, but another one in the 1890s, for example, was a brand new farmer MP from Canterbury who came up to Parliament for the first time and obviously, you know, wanted to enjoy himself. And before too long, he was rolling down the hill from down Molesworth Street onto Lambton Quay, very badly drunk. But unfortunately, he mistook what was the navigation lights on the end of the wharf for the chemist's shop, and he headed off along the wharf, tottering along until he fell off the end. And after several hours, as reported, clinging to a piece of timber in the harbour, he was finally rescued. But that was a slightly unfortunate episode from the point of view of those who wanted to continue to have access to alcohol, because it occurred exactly the time when the temperance movement was becoming really important in New Zealand.
Sick of high rates of alcoholism, violence and debaucherous raucousness on the streets, the temperance movement had gathered steam in the late 19th century. And before long, the big party that was Parliament was in focus. They also suspected that measures such as giving women the vote, which was in large part driven by the temperance movement, were not getting a fair hearing in Parliament's patriarchal pit. While there were sympathisers, John Martin says most members wouldn't have a bar of temperance.
Within a few years, there was sufficient pressure that Premier Dick Seddon had to kind of, because I don't think he wanted to introduce prohibition into Parliament at all. He was quite good mates with a lot of the liquor barons. And so he quite cleverly engineered a regular poll of MPs as to whether they wanted liquor to be provided. And so this poll would run every Parliament, but the pattern was usually that the House, having quite an influx of temperance-inclined people as MPs, would tend to be 50-50. But the old Legislative Council, where you had these bewhiskered gentlemen from the past, the old guard, if you like, from the 19th century, they would virtually to a man vote, apart from a few appointments by the Liberal government who were more serious types, they would vote for the continuance. And those polls continued to run for a long, long time, but they always were in favour.
Yep, you heard that right. They asked themselves if they wanted to keep their cheap quality grog, and of course the answer was always yes. But they had more than that. Until the 1960s, Parliament exempted itself from liquor laws. MPs could drink on Sunday. They didn't even have to scramble for the notorious 6 o'clock swill. They had exempted themselves. When Labour MP John A. Lee arrived at Parliament in 1922, he found a house of big halls and lots of drinking, as he recalled in this 1975 documentary.
We had our £7 a week, of course, and had to pay for our own board. And it's safe to say that a large number of members of Parliament stayed over for the weekend. Bellamy's on Sunday night generally had good gatherings.
Yes.
I think there was more discussion among members.
Yes.
Of course, we didn't have so many individual rooms. Mm. Old Massey had an idea that it was bad for members to have individual rooms because it led to plotting and planning and little cliques. And Seddon had the same idea, that all of the members of his party should be herded into one big whips room so that everybody could hear what was going on.
As New Zealand shifted, Parliament's habits lagged far behind. Bellamy's remained an institution, and MPs continued to drink hard. Until the 1980s, drunken MPs were semi-regular bait for scandal, such as this 1987 one between Nationals' Jim Bolger and Labour's Richard Preble over an incident in the Chatham Islands.
And why did they want to attack their own aircraft? Only one explanation, sir. They wanted to get at the grog cabinet. That, sir, is what they were trying to do. There has never been a more bizarre example of total juvenile ministerial behaviour, sir. The only excuse we could offer, sir, is the one that's been given to me, and that is they were stone-cold drunk.
I remember a National Party Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker, who used to every Thursday drink a bottle of gin, and then his staff used to have to go down to the basement, let his tyres down on his car to prevent him from driving out of the building. We all know that that is true, and we all know which member that I'm referring to. And I just say to the members opposite, if they want to chuck muck, I'm not the right person to throw it at.
But John Martin says that in the 1980s, Parliament started to change. Aided in part by Sir Geoffrey Palmer's reforms to Parliament's schedule and sitting times, but also the fact that, well, it was finally starting to catch up with society, albeit a couple of decades late.
It wasn't really until the 1970s and 1980s that whole male-focused culture began to shift. And you can see it not only in Bellamy's, but also in the lounge lobby that was in Parliament House that is now called the Grand Hall, where they had their billiard tables. And that was, again, a male inner sanctum. And was pretty tough for women to even walk through it, let alone inhabit it. Helen Clark in the 1980s said, you know, she felt that pressure of opprobrium just by merely going through the Grand Hall when it was that lounge with the billiard tables in it. And Whetū Tirukati Sullivan in the 1970s began to sort of break down some of those barriers, and some concessions were being made to women, but really as a sort of a marginal acknowledgement, if you like, rather than what we have today, which is really a completely different environment, isn't it? Not just the family-friendly parliament, but also the sorts of practices that might occur in the chamber. Women, forms of dress, breastfeeding, looking after infants, etc., etc. It's all totally changed from that male culture.
Yeah, such a dramatic change over 30 years, I guess. What led to it happening so fast, or was it just so slow to catch up? Or?
Probably Parliament was rather slow. It was a bit in a bit of a lag, but it had to catch up, and society, you know, was changing dramatically in the 1960s and 1970s, and so this was a slightly lagged reflection of that. I mean, the men had a good go for more than 100 years in Parliament, hadn't they? So maybe it was time.
And that's the House for today. Special thanks to Ngā Taonga for the archive audio.
Thanks, Jamie. That was Jamie Tahana with his show Gin and Beer It, Parliament's Boozy Past. It's part of The House, a podcast series which looks behind the scenes at how Parliament works. You can find more episodes of that excellent show at rnz.co.nz on the podcast and series page. You can also find it on your favourite podcasting app of choice. Just search for RNZ The House. Also, please remember, as always, to subscribe, leave a rating on iTunes, and share it with your friends. Ka kite anō.